How's your car looking? Showing its age? Faded paint? Dents? Dings? Don't worry. Maaco is here to help. They're the experts in affordable paint jobs and light collision repairs, helping you keep your car looking its best without breaking the bank. With Maaco's national reach and community focus, you're not just getting top-notch service. You're actually getting a partner you can trust. Visit your local Maaco today and see how they can refresh your ride. Go in, get the free estimate, and the expert technicians will handle the rest. Uh-oh, better get Maaco.
Life's messy. We're talking spills, stains, pets, and kids. But with Anabay, you never have to stress about messes again. At washablesofas.com, discover Anabay sofas, the only fully machine washable sofas inside and out, starting at just $699. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, that means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Upgrade your space today. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Merkel Media.
The Ark of the Covenant, an object described as the throne of God, a container of divine power, and a symbol of eternal authority. It's a story that has been passed down through generations, yet its true nature remains elusive. Ancient texts tell of its power to destroy armies, its ability to part seas, and the strange death that awaits those who dare to touch it without reverence. But what if these stories are just the beginning? In the deserts of Ethiopia, a small church claims to house the Ark itself. For centuries, it has been guarded by a single monk, sworn to never leave his post. But why does no one else know what's inside? And why has no one ever laid eyes on it? And why does the government of Ethiopia refuse to speak on its existence? And what about the rumors that the Ark was hidden in a secret location beneath Jerusalem? A location so guarded that even the most powerful institutions on Earth have failed to uncover it. But there's more, much more. We'll go beyond the traditional search for a physical artifact and examine a few stranger possibilities. Like, what if the Ark isn't a simple relic? What if it's something more advanced? A kind of lost technology? A machine, perhaps, designed to do far more than we ever imagined? Could the Ark be the key to an ancient secret? One that could change the world's understanding of power, life, and death? Some say the Ark's power isn't just spiritual, it's technological. And those who seek it are not just after its religious significance, but something darker, more profound. Something so dangerous that it could rewrite history. And I'm not just talking about ancient times, no. What if this search is still ongoing, right now, under our very noses? But before we continue, we must ask ourselves this question. What's the true cost of finding the Ark? Is the world prepared for what's locked away inside? Or is it better left forgotten, lost in the dark corners of history? And in our search, we may find something much more than we expected. Something not just from the past, but something that's been watching us all along. Welcome to the hunt for the Ark of the Covenant. A search that may lead us down paths no one has dared to walk. Prepare yourselves. Because nothing is what it seems.
Huh.
Hello, citizen. This content creator is a confirmed conspiracy theorist and has been subject to repeated penalties for spreading controversial rhetoric. Please proceed with caution, trust the government, remain silent. Your compliance is appreciated and, of course, non-negotiable.
Acquiring the Confessionals Podcast of Cyberspace. The Confessionals Podcast of Cyberspace has been acquired.
Beneath the unrelenting blaze of the Sinai sun, amidst the vast desolation of the wilderness, the voice of the Almighty calls to Moses. From the sacred heights of the mountain, God commands the creation of a vessel unlike any other, a sanctified chest, a divine throne that will house His presence on earth. The instructions are delivered with celestial precision, every detail infused with divine intent. The Ark of the Covenant is to be forged. From the resilient and revered acacia wood, the Ark is to take its shape. Its frame is a testament to both endurance and the sanctity of the item. Clad in a shimmering coat of pure gold, both within and without, the Ark will gleam as a tangible sign of God's eternal covenant with His chosen people. Its dimensions are exact and immutable, 2.5 cubits in length, 1.5 cubits in both width and height, a symmetry that reflects the perfection of the divine. Atop this sacred chest, the cherubim, which are majestic winged figures, are to be placed, their wings arched toward one another in an eternal gesture of reverence, their gazes fixed upon the center. The centerpiece, the mercy seat, will become the very locus of God's presence, the place where the invisible meets the tangible, where the infinite communes with the finite. But the Ark is more than just a vessel. It is a throne of glory, an earthly conduit for the divine. Within its gilded walls will rest the tablets of the Ten Commandments, inscribed by the finger of God Himself. These sacred stones are more than just relics. They are the embodiment of divine law, a covenant written in permanence, binding heaven and earth. Under Moses' guidance, the Israelites set to work, each act of craftsmanship imbued with profound reverence. The labor is meticulous, a blend of artistry and devotion, for this is no ordinary creation. It is the heart of their faith, the beacon of their identity. As the Ark is completed, it transformed from a crafted object into a symbol of unmatched power and divine favor. It is the harbinger of victory, the shield of protection, and the seat of justice. With the Ark of the Covenant completed, it assumes its rightful place at the heart of the tabernacle, and the sacred and portable dwelling of God's presence that the Israelites carry through their wilderness journey is also symbolic of our temporary body. Enshrined within this holy sanctuary, the Ark becomes the spiritual epicenter of the Israelites' faith, a testament to the divine power that guides and sustains them. The responsibility of the Ark's safekeeping rests with the Levites, the consecrated tribe chosen to bear its weight and guard its sanctity. Carried upon poles, as no human hand may touch the surface of the Ark, it moves with the people, its presence evoking both reverence and dread. It is amongst the people carried by the Levites. To behold it is to face the tangible power of God, of heavenly forces, a force that inspires awe among the faithful and strikes terror into all of their foes. As the Israelites approach the swollen banks of the Jordan River, the Ark leads the procession. It's borne by the priests at the vanguard. And the moment their feet touch the water, the river miraculously parts, and the waters pile up in heaps on either side, revealing a dry path for the Israelites to cross. It's a spectacle that echoes the parting of the Red Sea when they came out of Egypt, and it's a reminder of God's unyielding covenant. Later, the Ark plays a central role in the siege of Jericho, the fortified city standing as a barrier to the Promised Land. For 6 days, the priests carry the ark around the city's massive walls, a silent procession marked only by the sound of trumpets. On the seventh day, and that's important, remember, on the seventh day, they encircle the city 7 times. And as the trumpets blare in a final resounding blast, the walls of Jericho crumble. The city falls, not by sword or by siege engine. They weren't starved out. It was done by the ark's overwhelming power, a victory wrought by divine intervention. And the ark's journey becomes a living testament to the unassailable might of God. It was also a vessel of immense, terrifying power, and those who approach it without proper reverence or mishandled it in any way faced swift and often fatal consequences. One of the most tragic examples is the story of Uzzah, and we'll talk more about him a little bit later as well, but he reached out to steady the ark as it was being transported on a cart, and his action, though seemingly harmless and even well-intentioned, was a breach of the ark's sanctity, and in that moment, he was struck dead by God. There was something more going on with the ark. It was not to be touched by human hands. It demanded the utmost respect and obedience to God's commands. The biblical accounts of the ark portray it as a source of overwhelming energy, capable of both miraculous acts and devastating destruction. When the Philistines captured it and they took it to their cities, they were struck down by plagues and calamities that were so severe that they had to actually return the ark in desperation to the Israelites. They were unable to withstand its presence. This was no mere coincidence. It was the raw divine power of the ark at work. And I think that's a very important clue as to where the ark could be today. Descriptions of the ark often speak of it radiating a brilliant, blinding light, a force so intense that it seemed alive. Some have drawn modern comparisons to radiation, imagining the ark's energy as a dangerous, incomprehensible power that could literally destroy anyone who encountered it. The Bible describes how God gave Moses detailed instructions on how to construct the Ark of the Covenant. We talked about it a little already, but I want to just get in a little bit deeper. These precise instructions, which were received from God himself, could be viewed as a blueprint for creating an object of immense power. Let's look at this from the perspective as the Ark might be technology for a little bit, because we have to consider there are lots of things mentioned in the Bible that could be interpreted as tech, and I think we all know that. We have the wheel within the wheel, we have the golden chariots, we have Jacob's ladder, we have the Ark of the Covenant, we have the Spear of Destiny. Like, we have all sorts of stuff. The Spear of Destiny actually could be a mythical object, no tech involved, just because it pierced Jesus' side, but these other things could literally be tech. And given the whole UFO disclosure thing and how a lot of Christians right now believe that aliens are demons or fallen angels or something like that, I think it could be not too far of a stretch to say that maybe this kind of stuff actually is technology. And even though God is all powerful, he still instructs us to make tech. It's interesting, right? Like, it definitely raises some questions about the nature of spiritual beings. Let's keep that in mind a little bit as we go forward. Just as modern scientists follow precise formulas to construct nuclear weapons, so too Moses would have followed God's exact specifications, and God knows how to make a nuke, to build something that incredible and with such potential. We talked a little bit about what the Ark was made of already, but let's talk about it again in the terms of technology. The Ark of the Covenant, as described in the Bible, was constructed with very specific materials and features that hold spiritual and intriguing physical significance. Each element of its design not only reflected this intention of God, but also inspired modern interpretations, suggesting that there is some kind of deeper understanding of energy and power here. Acacia wood and gold are what the Ark was made of, right? And these are durable and sacred materials. Modern perspectives highlight its exceptional properties as a conductor of electricity, right? So there's some intriguing questions there. Was gold chosen for its symbolic value alone, or could it also have been intended as a material capable of channeling some energy within the Ark? Obviously energy, you know, ordained by God, created by God, etc. It doesn't diminish God's power at all if the Ark is tech made by the instructions of God. Atop the Ark were two cherubim, and their wings were outstretched and facing one another, overshadowing the mercy seat. Again, we can read all about this in Exodus 25. Traditionally, these were seen as heavenly beings guarding the divine throne. The cherubim's positioning has inspired interpretations that connect them to the flow of energy. Nowadays, we just see them in our grandma's room decorating Christmas trees and stuff like that. But some theorize that their wings may symbolize electromagnetic fields or even the channeling of energy across the Ark. A focal point of power was this mercy seat, and the golden lid of the Ark is where that was, and that is where God's presence was said to manifest. It was a sacred meeting point between heaven and earth here on this mercy seat. And from a modern lens, the mercy seat could be likened to the core of a powerful device, a portal of some sort. The mercy seat could be likened to the core of some sort of nuclear reactor. It could be concentrating and releasing energy in extraordinary ways, like the central element of a nuclear device. This focal point could represent a place where divine energy was gathered, magnified, and unleashed. That's from an extremely tech point of view. Personally, I believe it's a combination of both. I do think God's power manifested because he said it would, so it's probably true. This theory suggests that the Ark, though, was more than just this religious box, this artifact. It could have literally been a weapon that was given to the people temporarily to not only show that God is all-powerful and God knows all, but also to accomplish something that had to be accomplished by human hands with help. God couldn't just pave the way. You still got to do it. And that's why they wandered around in the desert for 40 years or whatever, or the wilderness for 40 years, trying to figure out, like, if they should trust God or not. Yes, dude, just trust. Just trust God. Take your Ark of the Covenant and go do stuff. Some of the effects of the Ark are pretty crazy when you compare them to radioactive weapons. So we have the Ark's catastrophic effects of plagues and sudden deaths like Azah, and those are both likened to effects of radiation exposure, including sickness and untimely fatalities. Then we've got the mercy seat, where God's presence was said to literally manifest, and that is, like we already said, kind of interpreted as this focal point of energy, maybe where a laser beam would come from or whatever. Of course, we know that's where God manifested. The fact that the Levites were sort of preordained to carry the Ark, I believe that there's actually an ancient bloodline here. So what do you guys think? Did God give Moses the blueprint for a weapon? Taking the Philistines into consideration, who captured the Ark during a battle, triumphantly believing they had seized Israel's ultimate treasure. We talked about this a little bit already. But their victory was soured because the Ark became a literal curse upon them, and plagues swept through their cities, their people fell ill, and chaos just generally consumed their land. And the once proud captors of the Ark of the Covenant were now terrified of that very thing. So, freaking out, they returned the Ark to the Israelites because they just wanted to get rid of it. So whether this is a divine relic or some kind of ancient mechanism of destruction, the Ark definitely carried an undeniable force even when it wasn't being used. And just whatever that is could turn entire cities to ruin. Just imagine being one of these fallen angels and hearing through the New Angel Times or whatever, that God invented a weapon, that God has given his favorite person, Moses, a weapon. And it's a big one. But we know that God is often busy. So he's got to give his army the tools they need to get it done, and they have to be strong enough to walk through the wilderness by faith. They still got to do it. God's not going to do it for them. The Ark's journey to Jerusalem, which is kind of like one of the last places we really know the Ark was as dramatic as it was significant. So King David, understanding the ark's pivotal role in Israelite worship and its symbol of God's presence, sought to bring it to the heart of his new capital. And this was no ordinary relocation. It was a royal procession. It would have been known about throughout the land, and it was marked by celebration and music and worship, and you can read all about it in 2 Samuel 6. But the journey was not without tragedy because of Uzzah. As the ark was being transported on a cart, one of its handlers, Uzzah, reached out to steady it when the oxen that was pulling the cart tripped. And the moment his hand touched the ark, he was struck dead. And shocked and afraid, David halted the whole thing. He says, "Stop, we're taking a break. Uzzah just got smited." And they leave the ark temporarily in the house of Obed-Edom. And the ark remained there for 3 months, during which time Obed-Edom and his household were greatly blessed. This blessing reassured David that God's favor could still rest upon the ark if handled properly. So, sorry God, I put the ark in a cart instead of getting the Levites to carry it, but God still wanted to let you know, you messed up, but I can still do good by this if you handle it properly. So how did they handle it properly if it just wasn't moving? It still needs to be in the care of Levites. And that's where the story gets kind of interesting, because who is Obed-Edom and where does he live? It's an interesting part of the story, as small as it is. Obed-Edom is identified as a Gittite in 2 Samuel 6:10, which typically refers to somebody from Gath or its surrounding areas. Gath was one of the cities of the Philistines. But in this context, Obed-Edom may have been an Israelite living near Gath, which is a Levitical city assigned to the Kohathites, which are talked about in Joshua 21, 24 through 25. And this suggests that he was possibly a Levite. And this would make sense, considering his house, which is now the resting place of the ark for 3 days or 3 months, three also being the number of God, by the way, and also the amount of days prior to his resurrection. So therefore, Obed-Edom's house is also a tabernacle. And this is an interesting presentation of how God uses history to play games and to get stuff done. And he knew Obed-Edom was a Levite, but Obed-Edom was not a practicing priest of the Levites. We're looking at this bloodline thing again. Nevertheless, it is part of his inherent duty as a descendant of that line to care for the ark, right? Because he's a Levite. And certain people are connected to certain ancestors. It's just the way it is. And that does give them a real purpose that maybe others don't have, even in these seemingly purposeless times. Never forget that you have a purpose of some sort. The Levites were set apart by God to perform duties related to the tabernacle and its sacred items, including the ark, which is Numbers 150 through 53 is where you can read about that. And this role was granted after the incident of the golden calf, when the Levites demonstrated loyalty to God by standing against the idolatry. Uzzah, needless to say, was not a Levite. And this really makes you wonder if the ark is volatile, like some kind of machine or weapon that can't be handled carelessly. He touched the reactor accidentally. Because he didn't have any ill intentions. He was just smited for doing something that he shouldn't have done accidentally for the right reasons. So was this a sign from God due to improper handling? And you guys might be asking yourself, who the heck cares? And we're getting to it. There's a lot more to go. But all this is really important for figuring out where the ark is today. Eventually, David did resume the journey, and this time with even greater care, of course, because the ark was carried by Levites this time. And when the ark finally entered Jerusalem, David placed it in a special tent that he had already had prepared, and the ark remained in this temporary sanctuary throughout David's reign. The tabernacles are temporary, guys, and that is where the Ark of the Covenant is meant to rest. That's interesting, right? This most sacred and powerful of object in a temporary tent. Tent! What do you do with tents? You set them up when you go camping or somewhere you're only going to be for a little while, and then you tear them down and you go somewhere else and you set it up there, and then you do the same thing over again. Pretty interesting that this isn't in some magnificent fortress or something, right? So is the ark a temporary thing, is it also meant to be temporary? Now, where David envisioned, Solomon realized, and a temple was constructed. King Solomon, who was David's successor, undertook the monumental task of constructing a permanent dwelling for the ark. But it starts to get interesting from here on out. This was the first temple of Jerusalem, and it was no ordinary structure. It was a masterpiece of craftsmanship, adorned with gold and precious metals, and designed to reflect the glory of the God that it was built to honor, and designed to be worthy of his presence amongst them, the Ark of the Covenant. And when the temple was completed, the Ark was brought from its tent into the Holy of Holies, which was the innermost sacred chamber of this temple. And the transfer was no mere ritual. It was a moment of profound spiritual significance. The Levites carried the Ark into its new home, and as they did, the temple was filled with this cloud of glory, and it was a visible sign of God's presence amongst his people. And by the time Solomon placed the Ark in the Holy of Holies, it had traveled a long and storied path. We know where it was up until that point. From the wilderness of Sinai, through battles and exile, to the very heart of Israel's political and religious life, its placement in the temple symbolized the culmination of God's covenant with the Israelites. The Ark's journey from a portable vessel carried by wanderers to the heart of this grandest temple mirrored the spiritual journey of the Israelites themselves, from nomadic tribes to a united kingdom under God's rule. It could also be symbolic of the journey of Christ. It could be symbolic of so many things, but what it's really pointing to, in my opinion, is this idea that it is meant to be temporary, and the Ark, upon fulfilling its purpose, would no longer be needed. Still glorious, and still a message from God, and a symbol of his divine presence, but not necessarily needed for the future. And that is sort of proven by what happens in the 6th century BC. Disaster strikes. The Babylonians besiege Jerusalem, and the Temple of Solomon is destroyed. The Ark is completely lost to history. From here on out, there are no clear records of what happened to it. That's it. And some believe that it was hidden by the prophet Jeremiah before the Babylonians arrived, and he concealed it in like a cave beneath Mount Nebo. But others claim it was carried away to Babylon. Judging by how well taking it from the Israelites worked for the Philistines, I don't really know why we could believe that it would work with the Babylonians. It's very possible that the Ark is completely uncapturable. If it really had fulfilled its purpose, this is where I could say, or I could, you know, venture to assume that maybe God sort of just decided he wasn't going to use the Ark of the Covenant anymore, and the Babylonians melted it down, destroyed it. It's possible if God ordained such a thing to happen. Some say the Ark was buried deep beneath the ruins of the temple, and it's still there awaiting the day that it'll be revealed to the world once again. Some people believe that the Ark of the Covenant is actually in Jerusalem right now, but prior to that, it had spent some time at Mar-a-Lago, where Donald Trump lives. So over the centuries, the Ark's legacy takes on mythic proportions. It's a divine machine, and we're seeing a lot of machines that appear somewhat divine in the air these days. Some say that it was returned to God, that it literally returned to God some way, whether that's transcending or going through a dimensional wall, or God literally coming and snatching it up or sending angels to get it. It was just brought back to heaven. So, you know, is the Ark sentient and able to move about on its own? I don't know. It's kind of weird that we're talking about UFOs that are, you know, considered biological in the modern times. So I don't know if the Ark did its own thing because God told it to, or if it was taken, or if it was destroyed. Maybe it's still there. But I digress. In 586 BC, the mighty Babylonian Empire, led by King Nebuchadnezzar II, laid siege to Jerusalem. The city of David, the heart of the ancient kingdom of Judah, was literally crumbling under the weight of Babylonian power. The first temple, the one that was built by King Solomon to house the Ark of the Covenant, was about to be obliterated. But the ark, it was gone. It vanished. And we don't see it in the Bible, and we don't see it in historical texts after this. So as the Babylonian forces advanced, Jerusalem was ransacked. The Temple of Solomon was burned to the ground. Artifacts of immense significance were looted and destroyed, including the golden altar, the golden lampstand. This is kind of stuff that we do know about, and the table for the showbread. But when they stormed the temple, they did not find the ark, apparently. In fact, there's no mention of it being taken. So we don't know what happened to it. One of the most compelling theories comes from a passage in the book of Maccabees, which is not technically Bible canon. I think a lot of people consider that outside of Bible canon, but it's an ancient Jewish text which tells a pretty fascinating story. It claims that the prophet Jeremiah, the one who prophesied the destruction of Jerusalem and therefore knew that that was going to happen, hid the ark before the Babylonians even arrived at the gates. He took the ark and went up to Mount Nebo, the same place where Moses had been shown the promised land before his death. And in a remote cave on this mountain, Jeremiah is said to have left the Ark of the Covenant along with this tabernacle and some other sacred items. So the Maccabees suggest that Jeremiah spoke of the place where he hid the Ark, but said that it would remain a secret until God chose to reveal it. And I don't know, that raises an important question, I think. Is the Ark still on that mountain, in that cave? And if so, could it one day be uncovered? For centuries, explorers of, you know, treasure hunters, archaeologists, Indiana Jones types, they've scoured Mount Nebo looking for the Ark. Why? Of course. But if it has been found, nobody's said anything about it. And after the destruction of the temple, the Ark, you know, having disappeared entirely from historical and biblical record, just kind of falls into ambiguity. There's no prophecies about it. There's no Babylonian texts. It just stops being talked about altogether. There's a possibility that between King Solomon and King Nebuchadnezzar II, the Ark just stopped being talked about, and it was just literally forgotten. It just faded into ambiguity. And during that time, perhaps God took it up to heaven with him or took it back. Either way, the Babylonians may not have even expected to find it there. They may have just forgotten about it altogether or just thought of it as an item from legend. So in Jeremiah 3:16, God speaks of a time when Israel will return to him and when people will no longer say, "The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord." This passage has led many to speculate that the Ark's disappearance is tied to divine prophecy, signifying that the Ark's physical presence is no longer needed to fulfill God's promises. So if it's no longer needed, maybe it's not here anymore. For millennia, the Ark's absence from the sacred spaces of Judaism and Christianity and Islam left a gaping void that people just attempt to fill with these legends and these conspiracy theories and these movies and this entertainment and all that kind of stuff. But naturally, one would expect the Ark of the Covenant to be somewhere in the Middle East, right? I did. It could even be somewhere in, like, Jerusalem still. You know, that's fine with me. But we would simply have no idea, or the government that has it, because I don't think it's just some private little old man who has the Ark of the Covenant. If it was the government of Israel or the United States or something like that, then they wouldn't be telling us that they have it. It literally goes against the entire narrative. So even if the Ark of the Covenant was found, we wouldn't hear about it because it just shatters the narrative of evolution. It shatters what we know or what we are educated is real. So it would be like finding Bigfoot, or it would be like, you know, a gray alien on Fox News or like something like that. Like, it just wouldn't happen because it would shatter the known reality and people would probably lose it. But if it is still in Jerusalem, it's interesting to note that beneath the holy city is a labyrinth of tunnels and chambers that has long been rumored to hide many different secrets, not just the Ark. For centuries, archaeologists have been captivated by the idea that the Ark was concealed beneath the Temple Mount, or that it was hidden in one of the city's many secret underground chambers during a time of crisis. That the idea of the Ark is not that it's lost, but it's been deliberately hidden, right? The Temple Mount itself, which is one of the holiest sites in all three Abrahamic religions, is a sacred and very politically charged area. It's a place of unimaginable significance. And don't forget, this is basically what the Crusades were all about, or so they say, for hundreds of years in the medieval ages. And where the first temple, built by King Solomon, once stood is where the Temple Mount is. And then after the destruction of that temple, the Ark disappeared, and it was sort of hidden in a complex tunnel system beneath the Temple Mount. Is it there? Probably not. And if not, it's probably because the governments of the world, the archaeologists, the Smithsonian, all these powers that be, that these organizations, these secret cults, all this kind of stuff, if it was under the Temple Mount or something like that, that would almost be like the first place you look. And so if it was there at one point, it's my personal opinion, it's probably not still there. If it's in Jerusalem, I would say it's like in a bunker guarded heavily by armed men, and it's maybe considered part of their military complex. That's how I would, if it was held by modern hands, assume it to be. There's another interesting idea, including the famous Western Wall tunnels and the more obscure Zedekiah's Cave, which I found kind of weird. Zedekiah's Cave is located beneath the old city of Jerusalem. And again, it's this vast network of tunnels and rooms that runs under the city. And according to legend, this is the place where King Zedekiah, who was the last king of Judah before the Babylonian exile, tried to escape as his city was besieged. There's more than one way to get out of Jerusalem in the situation that a siege takes place, apparently. And in the 19th century, explorers noted a strange feature within these caves. They found these large rectangular blocks of stone, many of which seemed out of place. And some suggest that these blocks were used as altar platforms, while others believe that they were just part of a storage system used to hide sacred relics during the fall of the First Temple. Nobody really knows. But it's possible that the Ark could have been concealed in one of these rooms, sort of hidden beneath the city's foundations in a place so secret that only the highest priests and kings knew about it. And then there's this other guy, Charles Warren, and his mysterious shaft. Not that shaft. He found his shaft and he called it Warren's Shaft. And it's this vertical tunnel that was discovered in the 1860s by this guy. And the shaft is believed to have been used as a water system for the ancient city, but it also curiously connects directly to an underground tunnel network. And some historians and archaeologists, of course, say that it could have been used as a secret escape route, perhaps even to move the Ark of the Covenant to safety during these times. There's another really tantalizing theory, I guess you could say, about the Ark, that it might have been hidden beneath the Western Wall of Jerusalem. And the Western Wall is the last remaining remnant of the Second Temple. And it also has been a site of pilgrimage and prayer for centuries. But beneath it, some believe, is another little secret room. And all we're really learning is what we always find out on the 21CD podcast, and that's that there's something inside the earth. There's underground tunnels and underground rooms and underground structures all over the place. When is the last time you went underground into a crypt or something? Probably a long time, if ever. Most people never go down into a crypt or find some lost underground tunnel that leads to miles of more tunnel. And that's exactly the point. We have no idea what's down there. But in modern times, the prevailing theory seems to lie in a small church in a country called Ethiopia. Ethiopia? How? And why, right, would the Ark be there? In the ancient world, there were few places more mysterious and remote than the Kingdom of Ethiopia, however. It's known in biblical texts as Cush. It was a land of powerful kings, great wealth, and deep religious traditions. But among the most intriguing and tantalizing theories surrounding the Ark of the Covenant is the claim that the Ark, which was long believed to have been lost in Jerusalem, right, was actually taken to Ethiopia, and that it remains hidden in the heart of this ancient Ethiopian kingdom to this day. And when we look at the story of how that could have happened, it's really not that weird, because they are willing to say that they have it. Like, the Ethiopian government pretty much just comes out and says, we got it,
We have the Ark. And they're the only people who say that. They're very proud of it. But is it true? Is the Ark actually hidden in this remote church in Ethiopia? The story of the Ark's journey to Ethiopia begins with one of the most famous and mysterious figures in biblical history, the Queen of Sheba. The Queen of Sheba, who is known for her wealth and her wisdom and her beauty, is said to have made a momentous visit to the court of King Solomon in Jerusalem around the 10th century BC. And the Bible recounts that she traveled great distances, bringing gifts to Solomon, testing his wisdom with difficult questions, and receiving answers that amazed her. But the Ethiopian tradition takes this story a step further. According to the ancient Ethiopian manuscript, the Kebra Nagast, which is translated as the Glory of Kings, the Queen of Sheba didn't simply visit Solomon to marvel at his wisdom. There was a little something going on during that visit, and she became pregnant by him, and she bore a son, and that son's name was Menelik the First. And that's where the mystery deepens. The Kebra Nagast claims that Menelik grew up in Ethiopia, but upon reaching adulthood, he traveled to Jerusalem to meet his father. And during this journey, Menelik was said to have been entrusted with one of the most sacred and powerful items in the world, the Ark of the Covenant. And according to the legend, Solomon, who understood the power of the Ark and foresaw the eventual danger of its presence in Jerusalem, decided that the Ark should be sent to Ethiopia for safekeeping. That way it would be far from the ever-present threat of these invading armies. Jerusalem was about to head into a very tumultuous time. Honestly, they could have used the Ark, but again, not part of the plan. The legend goes that Solomon arranged for a divine transfer of the Ark, and he gave it to Menelik, who brought it back to Ethiopia with him. And according to the Kebra Nagast, Menelik didn't just bring the Ark with him, he also brought it to the ancient Ethiopian city of Aksum, where it was placed, and it was placed in this special little hidden chamber and guarded by a group of priests whose responsibility it would be to protect the Ark for eternity. And some say that this group of priests, like, interchange, but the thing that I'm actually finding more is that it's one priest who basically guards this thing for until he dies, I guess. And there's some weird traits of these priests, like they often go blind during this service and stuff like that. So I'm not sure, but if you look into the priests themselves, you get this kind of blend of mysterious and gimmicky. And it's kind of like, I don't know if this was true. This feels like something that should be in Star Wars or Lord of the Rings. And there's another interesting story too, when it comes down to like, why Ethiopia? There did seem to be some kind of connection between Ethiopia and, like, the Israelites. I don't know what it was exactly. Maybe it was Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. Maybe that really is the connection. But there's another interesting story that is like, well, okay, if they have that, then maybe they do have the Ark. And the other thing that the Ethiopians apparently have or found was the Book of Enoch. And for those who don't know, the Book of Enoch is a mysterious text known only through, you know, whispers and ancient writings and stuff like that. It's not really talked about as Bible canon, but it references a lot of biblical things, and it was written, you know, in similar times to the Bible. And it was found deep in the highlands of Ethiopia. And they consider it scripture. Like, it's revered as this ancient scripture text. Unlike most Christian traditions, the Ethiopian church literally includes the Book of Enoch in its biblical canon. And a lot of us in this space use the Book of Enoch heavily to sort of form ideas on why the world is the way it is and who's actually in charge and what actually went down. Later discoveries, like fragments of the book, were found amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls, and that kind of confirmed its origins and its connection to early Jewish thought. And these fragments closely mirrored the Ethiopian text, affirming the remarkable accuracy of the preservation. So it really did appear like it came from there. And that's pretty wild when you think about it. So if they have the Book of Enoch, why wouldn't they have the Ark, right? What else do they have, as a matter of fact? Ethiopia has these deep Christian roots. You know, it's one of the oldest nations in the world to have adopted Christianity as its state religion. And in the 4th century AD, King Ezana of Aksum officially converted to Christianity. But Ethiopia's Christianity is very unique. It's not like other Western Christian traditions. And, you know, in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, it's still very ancient and mystical, and there's a lot of monastic practices from the old days. And central to this tradition is the claim that the Ark of the Covenant was brought there by Menelik, right? So they take this very, very seriously. And the Church of St. Mary of Zion in Aksum is considered to be that final resting place of the Ark. And the church is one of Ethiopia's most significant religious sites, right? It holds a unique role in this whole legend, this thing that, you know, the Ethiopian church really embodies. And no one's allowed to see the Ark, right? No one's allowed to go into the church and see it. Apparently nobody ever has. It seems sometimes like the priests are allowed to see it, but only on special occasions can he even go in to see it. Of course, there are rumors that beneath the church in Aksum is a tunnel system or some kind of crypt where the Ark is kept. So even if you don't see it in the church, it's because they got it hidden in the tunnels. Maybe the Ark is beneath the church. Maybe it is in a secret chamber. Who knows? Maybe it's underneath my bed. We're just all throwing stuff at the wall and hoping it sticks a lot of the times when we research this. Perhaps the priests do guard it and possess this weird knowledge of how to care for it, even though they're not Levites and all that kind of stuff. There's just some details of the Ark that make me believe that this particular possibility isn't really real. Nevertheless, there's some crazy stories about it. One of the most dramatic and chilling chapters in this ongoing mystery of the Ark of the Covenant involves a massacre and the potential theft of the Ark from Ethiopia. And it's an event that has long been questioned, shrouded in this sort of intrigue, and obviously it's very tragic. The story begins in the 17th century, a period of great turmoil in Ethiopia, by the way. And at that time, the Solomonic dynasty had ruled the kingdom of Ethiopia for centuries and traced its roots back to Menelik, the legendary son of King Solomon, right? And the dynasty was deeply intertwined with the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, which claimed to have safeguarded the Ark of the Covenant for generations, hiding it in the Church of St. Mary of Zion. However, in the mid-1600s, the Solomonic dynasty faced a serious threat from a new force, the Adal Sultanate, a neighboring Islamic kingdom. They needed the Ark back. Ethiopia's stability was also being shaken from within by, like, factional rivalries, and the monarchy's authority was weakening steadily. So, in this volatile environment, the Ark of the Covenant became not just a symbol of this divine authority, but also a political tool that they needed, a prize that could literally shift the balance of power. The dramatic and tragic events surrounding the Ark's potential theft took place in 1632, during the reign of Emperor Phasaelides. In 1632, Emperor Phasaelides, who had come to power in a period of deep internal chaos, faced a challenge from the Portuguese, of all people. Ethiopia had been a longtime ally of the Portuguese during the earlier centuries, and they had provided military support in fighting off external threats. However, Phasaelides, in a sort of bid for independence, severed ties with Portugal despite this alliance, leading to tensions between the two powers, obviously. Enter the Portuguese missionaries, many of whom had been in Ethiopia for decades and helping to spread Christianity and serving in high positions within the church. So these missionaries had heard the stories of the Ark of the Covenant being kept in the Church of St. Mary of Zion, because these Ethiopian Orthodox priests apparently hadn't followed the rules of Fight Club, and these Portuguese missionaries coveted the relic. They wanted it. So according to some reports, the Portuguese, believing that it's there, hearing that it's there, the priest saying that it's there, hatched this plan to steal it. Phasaelides, recognizing the growing risk of the Ark being seized by the Portuguese, made a decision, and he ordered that the Ark be moved from its safe location in Aksum to a more secure and hidden place in the capital city of Gondar. So his decision to move the Ark was obviously met with violence. The Portuguese were ready. But not just the Portuguese, also the high priests of the Church of St. Mary of Zion, the custodians of the Ark, who were fiercely loyal to their divine duty and very proud of the fact that they were the ones to care for the Ark. So they refused to relinquish it. And they knew that the Ark was not just an object of political power. It was the living embodiment of God's covenant to them. So, and they believed that that was direct to the Ethiopian people now. So somebody trying to steal the Ark of the Covenant was a big deal, even if it was their own people. Protecting the Ark was sacred. They would fight to the death before they saw it removed. And that's exactly what happened. According to the historical account, somewhere around 600 men, including priests and soldiers loyal to the church, were killed during this confrontation, and they were slaughtered in the name of protecting the Ark. Though the massacre is often presented as an attempt to preserve the Ark, some historians still argue that it was in fact the beginning of the Ark's disappearance from Ethiopia for good. In the wake of this violent incident, the Ark was believed to have been completely stolen by this group of Portuguese soldiers and missionaries who allegedly smuggled it out of Ethiopia under the cover of night. And the Ethiopians will deny that. But according to these accounts, the Portuguese, who were desperate to reclaim the Ark and take it back to Europe, secretly infiltrated Ethiopia's political and religious elite by making deals with certain factions of the Ethiopian court or church leaders, and they promised protection or influence, probably all the things that you get for exchanging in exchange for the Ark. And the stolen Ark was then said to have been transported back to Lisbon in Portugal, where it was stored in a church in the heart of the city and where it may still be. But other versions of the story suggest that the Ark was never actually taken to Portugal, and it just disappeared altogether from Ethiopia, but not necessarily because it went to Lisbon. Some believe that it was hidden away in Ethiopia somewhere else by factional forces, trying to secure it for themselves, perhaps to prevent it from being taken by external invaders, similar to how it was hidden when the Babylonians invaded Jerusalem. But following the massacre, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church remained adamant that the Ark had never left the country. So, who knows? But official records from the time are sparse and unclear, so there's really no way to prove it. And the Church of St. Mary of Zion still claims that it possesses the Ark, but nobody outside of the highest echelons of the Ethiopian clergy have ever been allowed to view it. Given the chance, I don't know if I would even want to see it. I'd be so scared. If somebody was like, we're going to show you the actual Ark of the Covenant, I'd be like, should I be seeing this? Either way, did the Portuguese steal the Ark? Does it remain in Ethiopia? Or is all of this barking up the wrong tree altogether? Who knows? But what is certain is that the Ark's disappearance after the massacre marks a turning point in the history of Ethiopia's relationship with the most sacred object in their religious history, the Ark of the Covenant. There are a lot of interesting threads that tie Ethiopia to King Solomon and the Ark of the Covenant, where it was when it was in Jerusalem. I mean, there's just a lot of little strings that tie this together. We have these real-world situations that seem to be involving the Ark in some way, but no real proof that the Ark is even where the confrontation is taking place. That's kind of peculiar. Some say that the Portuguese soldiers and missionaries who were in Ethiopia and managed to secretly seize the Ark and transport it away from its guardians brought it to Lisbon, and that would have been obviously the most logical destination. It's the capital of Portugal. And given the Portuguese connection to Ethiopia and their longstanding religious interest in the region, this just checks out. According to certain accounts, the Ark was said to have been housed in a church somewhere in Lisbon. But like many aspects of this story and a lot of what we've said already, the details are very vague and unverified. If it was taken to Portugal, the Ark would likely have been hidden away in one of the monastic vaults, right? Far away from where the public could even go. If it was put in a church, it probably wasn't put in a church that was used by everybody always. So this theory is supported by the history of European obsession with sacred relics, right? Like, those people over there are obsessed with this type of stuff, as well as the mythical traditions that surround objects of divine power. Like, even Napoleon had to go to Egypt just to see what's going on. So this all of this combines to strengthen the idea that some of these groups might have been looking for the Ark as well. So if it did get brought to Europe, These groups basically defined the narrative and how the world is today. And so it's possible they were able to get their hands on it, one group or another, whether it's the Crusaders or somebody else, right? The Freemasons. While the Ark might have been taken to Portugal, another plausible scenario is that the Ark actually was hidden and smuggled out of Ethiopia into other neighboring regions like Egypt or other parts of the Middle East, that it basically returned, especially given the complex network of trade routes and cultural exchanges that existed at the time. We would just have to ask ourselves why and under what situation the Ark was smuggled away like that. It would have to be pretty drastic, I think. In the 17th century, Cairo had long been a center of religion, though, and politics and culture, and it was a place where many holy relics and ancient artifacts from across the world were either kept or smuggled. And I know you guys remember when all of the Europeans were going all over the, not just the Europeans, but the Europeans are famous for it, going all over Africa and the Middle East and basically stealing all of their sacred relics, plundering these historical sites. Egypt's long history with the biblical narrative, though, and its proximity to Ethiopia, I guess kind of makes it a possible destination for the Ark, particularly if it was hidden to keep it away from European powers. You would just think, though, that Egypt is kind of like some of these other places where if it was there, they would have found it already, and they wouldn't have told anybody. But it is conceivable that the Ark could have been kept somewhere in Egypt in secret. The Ark may also have been moved north to places like Syria, Jordan, or Turkey, if we're going to follow that same sort of mindset, and it could have been concealed in very remote monasteries or caves or religious sites in this sort of situation. In the back of my mind, I can't picture like a couple little farmers carrying the Ark of the Covenant to hide it in some cave, though, because they found it. It might kill them. I don't know. What do you guys think? You know, the Jerusalem connection can't be ignored either. It's less likely that the Ark was brought back to Jerusalem, but these modern times are crazy. Who knows? And due to political and religious tensions right now, if somebody did have the Ark of the Covenant, now is when it probably should be revealed, right? And one of the more wondered about ideas is that it was taken by none other than one of the world's greatest losers, Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. And the Nazi regime was very interested in obtaining the Ark of the Covenant, believing that it could confer immense mystical and occult power. And this theory is part of a broader set of conspiratorial claims surrounding the Nazis' obsession with sacred relics. We know this was the case. They were obsessed with mystical things and the occult, and many researchers and historians have explored this connection between the Third Reich and the sort of occult world and this hunt for mystical artifacts. The Nazis were deeply involved in this, and their interest in ancient mystical things wasn't just limited to the Ark. Heinrich Himmler, who was the leader of the SS, was especially fascinated by occultism and esoteric traditions, and he believed that the Aryan race was descended from this, you know, ancient mystical civilization, and that the Nazis could access hidden knowledge and power and by uncovering these sacred relics a lot of the time. Hitler and Himmler were both influenced heavily by Germanic and Norse mythology, and they believed that certain ancient artifacts could help them control vast powers in other parts of the world. And that would provide the Nazis with a supernatural advantage to go along with their, you know, technological. And the Holy Grail, the Spear of Destiny, and other legendary objects are rumored to be among these objects that the Nazis were searching for, including the Ark of the Covenant, of course. The Nazis believed that the spear gave them military success, and Hitler was reportedly obsessed with it. So why wouldn't they be obsessed with the Ark, too? And the Nazis did indeed engage in the systematic plundering of religious relics across Europe during the war. It's well documented that the Nazis were particularly interested in items with significant historic and religious symbolism, including relics of Christianity and items related to other ancient religions. Many of these items were looted from churches and monasteries and synagogues all across Europe. You know, the idea that Hitler and the Nazis were after the Ark of the Covenant has been heavily popularized. I mean, just look at Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? The Nazis are depicted trying to obtain the Ark, believing that it would give them supernatural power. And this is a fictionalized account, but it does reflect a real theory that some Nazi officials believed the Ark could give them control over some cosmic forces in some kind of way. And if the Nazis did have it, just like everything else they had, when they were defeated at the end of World War II, everything they had would have just been quietly smuggled away, hidden away, stolen, taken, like we did with their scientists, who then went on to invent nuclear weapons and stuff like that, right? Rockets and all that kind of good stuff. Hitler had the Annenerbe, which was this SS organization dedicated to researching the ancient origins of the German people and studying the occult. Like, that's all they had to do. And they could have been tasked with investigating other sacred relics too, including the Ark. And as World War II ended and the Allied forces closed in on Berlin, the fate of many Nazi treasure hunters and their prized possessions became even more uncertain. So they would have acted more drastically. Much of the Nazi treasure, including looted religious artifacts, was just simply strewn about and hidden in secret locations or lost during the World War's final days. People just running into the woods with their stuff and chucking all their stuff, burying all the stuff they've looted and stolen. There were reports of Nazi officers fleeing with artifacts, hiding them in caves or burying them in remote locations to prevent them from falling into the Allied hands so maybe they could return for them later. If the Ark ever was part of their plunder, sure, it could have been hidden in one of these secret locations, maybe buried in Germany. But there is one little problem. If the Nazis did find the Ark, they probably didn't find it in Ethiopia, because Nazis never went to Ethiopia, though they did express a great interest in doing so. There were rumors that Nazi officers, particularly Heinrich Himmler, was fascinated with the possibility that Ethiopia held hidden religious relics tied to the mysticism and the occultism that they valued. And here's a very, very, very long story short. There is this strange idea. Even though the Nazis never went to Ethiopia, the Italians did. Their little buddies. The Italian invasion of Ethiopia was one of the key events in the lead-up to World War II. The invasion began on October 1935 and culminated in the conquest of Ethiopia by fascist Italy under Benito Mussolini in May 1936. This aggression had far-reaching consequences, both for Ethiopia, which had been the last independent African nation, and for global geopolitics, as it revealed the failure of the League of Nations and further demonstrated that aggressive expansionist policies wielded by the Axis powers, which would later include Nazi Germany, were a big problem. But guys, what's the focal point here of Italy? That's right. The Vatican. The Vatican. By the mid-1930s, Benito Mussolini, who had firmly established himself as the fascist dictator of Italy, sought to expand Italy's empire a little bit. He wanted to do that in Africa. It was part of his broader goal of restoring the Roman Empire's glory. And Mussolini's foreign policy was deeply tied to the idea of creating a new Roman Empire. And Ethiopia, an independent kingdom with a long history of resistance to colonization, sort of represented a final and significant challenge to Italy's aspirations in Africa. In 1929, Mussolini signed the Lateran Treaty with the Vatican, which recognized the sovereignty of the Vatican City as an independent state, and this is important. But this treaty granted Mussolini favor and legitimacy in the eyes of the Catholic Church, and in turn, the Vatican received protection and autonomy under Italian law. This is basically when the Vatican became its own country, when church and state merged to become one. And Mussolini, seeking to solidify his power, relied on the support of the Catholic Church to legitimize his regime and his expansionist goals. So the relationship between Mussolini and the Vatican, while strategic, was based on mutual interest. And they both wanted the Ark of the Covenant. Mussolini sought to portray himself as this defender of Catholicism, and the Vatican sought to protect its interest in Italy and the wider world. And the Ark of the Covenant is rumored to be in Ethiopia, which just so happens to be what kicks off World War II, because Benito Mussolini invades Ethiopia. Wild. So, given Mussolini's interest in Ethiopia and the potential for symbolic artifacts, it's completely plausible that if the Ark was ever there, it might have been a target for Italian forces. Additionally, Pope Pius XI and Mussolini were pretty close, and the Lateran Treaty had created a partnership between the two that almost went to friendship, and Mussolini might have wanted to negotiate with the Vatican regarding the Ark's fate if he had it, possibly offering it to the Vatican, to his buddy the Pope, Pius XI, as a gift or a symbol of Italy's victory in Ethiopia. But again, maybe none of this is on the head. Maybe all of this is false. After all, none of us know where the Ark is. That's what makes it so fun to research and talk about these things. But let me tell you what I think, and you might not like it. Hebrews 9:11 says, "But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands. That is to say, not of this creation. And not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood. He entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. Therefore, it was necessary for the copies of the things in the heavens to be cleansed with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. The earthly tabernacle was a teaching tool for the real one." And then Revelations 11:19 says, "Then God's temple in heaven was opened, and within his temple was seen the ark of his covenant. And there came flashes of lightning, rumbling, thunder, and this was all in the midst of the seventh trumpet sounding. And what was inside the ark? A jar with manna that the Jews ate during their time in the desert, the very manna that was supposed to die or rot the day that it falls. It can't be stored, so it's interesting that it was in the ark. The staff of Aaron that Aaron lifted up to save the Jews from the deadly snake bite. The Ten Commandments. Tell me though, aren't these all references to Christ? After all, he is the bread of life that came to us from heaven, right? He was nailed to the cross to save us from death, and anyone who looks on him will be saved. He is the fulfillment of the law of the Ten Commandments. When we follow him, we follow the commandments. Do you see what I'm getting at here? There is a monumental difference between the Old and New Testaments. And that difference at the core of it is that things go from being very literal to very spiritual. And a lot of the literal things kind of just break apart or die, or they're destroyed, and they're usually replaced with the spiritual thing. And given that the ark was a symbol of God's covenant, and so was Christ, I would say that it's not entirely unlikely that the ark has been destroyed completely by God. Maybe taken to heaven with him. Maybe he just reached down and plucked it and is like, they don't need this anymore. Complete with all of its components, the covenant being replaced by something spiritual. And yet the physical one still being too powerful for mankind in its current state because it's a tool of God has no place on earth. Again in Jeremiah 3:16, the prophet foretells a time when the ark will no longer be remembered or needed because God's presence will dwell directly with his people. In those days, when your numbers have increased greatly in the land, declares the Lord, people will no longer say, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. It will never enter their minds or be remembered. It will not be missed, nor will another one be made. The Ark's centrality would be sort of superseded by a new covenant, that one represented by Jesus Christ. So that's just my idea, right? It's not here anymore, guys. will never be found because it's not findable. What do you guys think? Let me know in the comments. Listen, thanks for experiencing 21st Century Dystopian. In case you've forgotten, my name is John. It was a pleasure hosting this episode of The Confessionals for Tony and for each one of you. It's been absolutely phenomenal hanging out with everyone, and I'd like to continue to be a part of your trajectory. So if you guys would like to find out if the Ark is actually hidden in my hallway under my bed, or, you know, being used as a shoebox in my closet or something like that, the last place you would ever expect to find it, then please search up the 21CD podcast, whatever platform you prefer. Just search 21CD. We're on Spotify, Apple, YouTube. I have videos of every episode everywhere. All right. And check us out. Give us a little follow. See if you like it. If you do, stick around a little bit. God bless you. Stay safe. And remember, don't drink the water. And question everything.
Cars today are built to last, but how they look is up to you, and that's where Mako comes in. They specialize in cosmetic repairs. Let's say it's affordable paint jobs to fixing those annoying dents and dings. Maybe your car's paint is faded, or you've been meaning to fix that scrape from the grocery store parking lot. Whatever it is, Mako has you covered. Now, here's the best part. Stop by your local Mako, free estimate, and you're going to find out how easy it is to refresh your ride. With more Americans keeping their cars longer, now's the time to protect your investment and keep it looking sharp for years. And you can do so with the great folks at Mako. At Mako, they are proud to be a trusted partner for drivers across the country. Whether it's a fresh coat of paint for your car or fixing up everyday dents and dings, Mako is here to keep your car looking its best. Get started. Visit your local Mako today. Get the free estimate and see how easy it is to bring new life to your ride. Uh-oh. Better get Mako.
Hey, everyone. This is Carrie Champion, the host of Naked Sports.
When you sit behind the wheel of the all-new 2025 Nissan Armada Pro 4X, you'll feel like the entire world is your playground. And you'd be right, because this unshakable fortress of a vehicle is built to take you on your next adventure. With a twin-turbo V6 engine, the all-new Armada is powerful enough to take you anywhere. With its 8,500 pounds of towing capacity, it will let you bring all your toys along. And with seating for eight, your whole crew can join you. Nissan created a truly capable vehicle in the all-new Armada. In fact, it's the first Armada to earn the Pro 4X badge, which Nissan reserves for its most adventure-ready vehicles. The Armada is a big SUV designed and built for big adventures. It must be experienced to be appreciated. Drive the all-new 2025 Nissan Armada today. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Intelligent four-wheel drive cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Time for a sofa upgrade? Visit washablesofas.com and discover Anabay, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices, with sofas starting at $699. Anabay brings you the ultimate in furniture innovation with a modular design that allows you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabay is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquid simply slides right off, Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink and feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get up to 60% off plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Let's be real. Life happens. Kids spill. Pets shed. And accidents are inevitable. Find a sofa that can keep up at washablesofas.com. Starting at just $699, our sofas are fully machine washable inside and out, so you can say goodbye to stains and hello to worry-free living. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, they're kid-proof, pet-friendly, and built for everyday life. Plus, changeable fabric covers let you refresh your sofa whenever you want. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa anytime to fit your space, whether it's a growing family room or a cozy apartment. Plus, they're earth-friendly and trusted by over 200,000 happy customers. It's time to upgrade to a stress-free, mess-proof sofa. Visit washablesofas.com today and save. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.